You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. A draft opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court shows there are probably enough justices ready to overturn the federal right to an abortion. The draft opinion was written by Justice Samuel Alito and leaked to Politico, which published it in full last night. It's important to note the opinion is not the final opinion. Justices could hypothetically change their minds ahead of their ultimate decision this summer. But according to Politico, there's still enough support among the court's conservative justices as of this week to overturn Roe v. Wade. We're talking about the significance of this leak from the Supreme Court and what it would mean if this draft opinion holds. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to this news? The likelihood now that Roe v. Wade would be overturned? Do you have questions about how it would affect Wisconsin and other states? Do you think this would be the right decision? Are you glad to see this? Are you worried about it? Do you think Congress should act one way or another on it, or state legislatures? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Charlie Jacobs is a professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
We're in a unique position here. This is a draft that's been leaked that is not a final decision necessarily. How likely do you think it is, though, that this that anything different would happen, that at least five justices wouldn't support this, knowing what we know now?
I think it's unlikely. I think one of the interesting issues here is that there's still about 2 months before the court would likely have announced this decision. And in court time, that's quite a bit of opportunity for persuasion on the merits and persuasion on the law. And in fact, that's what happened in 1992 with the Planned Parenthood v. Casey decision, one in which conservatives, particularly those on the court, thought that they had a victory overturning Roe versus Wade. But then we had three individuals peel off, Justices Kennedy, Souter, and O'Connor, and they sort of crafted a compromise agreement to sustain Roe, but create a different legal paradigm. And one wonders whether or not Roberts was hoping to try to do that. Now what's probably happened is it's going to harden those individuals who've already cast a vote, because they're not going to want to look as though they have given ground or were bending to pressure from the public or politicians or even internally in the court. So my suspicion is we've probably locked in the vote at 5-4, and Roberts has probably lost the remaining time that he had to persuade and to maybe move this on the merits so that Roe could be sustained.
What will this mean? If this, in fact, goes through this summer, what then happens in states around the country when it comes to abortion?
So what you're going to see happen is there are several states that have trigger provisions. One's where if Roe versus Wade falls, then automatically some laws go into place banning or restricting abortion rights in those states. Some never technically wiped their legislation from the books, so those would automatically go back into place. And I would suspect that some states that have been on the fence, I'm thinking states like Indiana, might begin to craft some legislation that would deal with the fallout from the decision from the court. And my suspicion is that would start almost immediately. So, you know, you're looking at dozens of states where the rights of women to exercise this privacy right would be fundamentally changed.
And Wisconsin is one of those states in that category you mentioned. We have a law going back to, I think, 1849, never taken off the books. That, in theory, if Roe versus Wade is overturned, that is on the books. It would make abortion, performing an abortion, a felony in all cases except to save the life of the mother, if I understand that correctly, Charlie.
That's my understanding, too. Again, I mean, this has been a long dormant law, and so it may take some reinterpretation, both by actors who have to enforce it, as well as state courts. So while, yes, we have the statute and it is likely to go into effect, if it would comport with what we're expecting the court to say, it may have to be amended slightly. So I'm not exactly sure if as written in it on the books at the moment is what you're going to see in effect if Roe versus Wade does get overturned.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College, looking at the leaked document from the U.S. Supreme Court, likely overturning Roe versus Wade as things stand now. opening up abortion restrictions in states around the country. You can join in with your reaction, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. In this document, Charlie, what is the case made by Justice Alito in terms of the legal rationale for overturning Roe?
Well, the argument that he seems to be making is that it was poorly argued when it was initially offered. And remember that Roe versus Wade was part of a series of cases that began in 1965 with Griswold versus Connecticut. And in the Griswold case, the court was dealing with whether or not a state could prohibit married couples from obtaining some sort of birth control device for themselves. And it was kind of a tortured argument there. And it was then extended to abortion rights in the 1973 case. And so his basic argument is that substantive rights, where you're basically arguing that individuals have a liberty interest to pursue some sort of activity, that these kinds of substantive rights are improper, at least in the context of abortion. And because of poor arguments and poor precedent that followed this particular case, it cannot be sustained. And part of what he's arguing here is there's no long-standing tradition in American history that this is a protected right, because this is a contested area of legislation. And as a result, he wants to return this back to the states so that they can argue as communities about whether or not they want to support and sustain this particular liberty. And so it's a states' rights argument. It's one that's sort of a technical one about either procedural or substantive rights. And so, you know, it's one that can be sustained on the merits. I mean, it's one that has been made ever since Roe versus Wade came down. But at the same time, after 50 years of supporting this particular view, it became almost concrete in sort of the legal venue that this was a right that could be sustained.
And the point has been made, I think, by many at this point, Charlie, that if a current Supreme Court, five justices could say, no, those seven with Roe v. Wade got it wrong back then by this standard, then the Griswold case you mentioned, saying states, yeah, you can't ban contraception. In that case, I think it was for married couples. Obergefell allowing same-sex marriage. The same standards might apply. A state could pass a law, bring it up to the Supreme Court, and we could see the same arguments used to overturn those?
We could, although apparently Alito is trying to cramp the decision, arguing that it only applies to abortion. And certainly the court can try to do that. But as we've seen with the case like Bush v. Gore that settled the 2000 election, where the court also said this has no precedential value. Courts have used the basic arguments from the court in that case, and there's nothing that's going to stop lower courts or state courts from applying this basic decision to other privacy-related and substantive rights. So you're correct. We're talking about possible bans on contraceptives. We're talking about possible bans on interracial marriage, on gay marriage, on gay sexual autonomy. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of potential for unraveling of rights that Americans have both become accustomed to and have supported over time. And I'll even go back to a case from 1925 where the court, in essence, created a liberty interest in parents being able to educate their children as they see fit, because there was a state law that prohibited sending kids to private schools. You could only have public education, which would have, in essence, banned parochial schools and other religious institutions. So there's lots of cases out there that can be affected. And it's, you know, it's that metaphor about tugging on the piece of yarn on your sweater before you know it, you don't have much of a garment of clothing left.
On the list is Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat, reacting to the draft opinion at a news conference today.
If we had to pick a word that our caucus feels, it's infuriated. Infuriated by the alleged decision, infuriated by the lies these justices told us when they said they'd respect precedent.
It's a strong accusation. Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, also suggested that she'd been misled by a couple of the Supreme Court nominees over the last few years who signed on to this apparent decision. What do you think? Is there a case to be made that they misled senators in their hearings?
Yeah, it's interesting how, depending upon what party you belong to and your position on the matter, the type of language you're using, misled or lied. So one of the difficulties for anyone who's been nominated to the bench at any level in the federal courts is that you don't want to take a position on any legal issue, because in the American judicial system, decisions are going to be fact dependent. So they have to be able to know what the facts are in the case, what the legal arguments are before they can rule. So to rule on a hypothetical or to speculate about a hypothetical when they're in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee puts them in a very difficult position. And so oftentimes individuals who are, you know, being vetted by the Senate Judiciary Committee will be coy, or they will try to sidestep answering a question directly. I think what's drawing some ire from senators is the question was rather direct to some of these nominees to the bench, both in private and during hearings. And it doesn't seem like they are waffling at all. They were pretty clear. This is standing precedent and we won't overturn it. And that suggests they didn't have a concern about the fact dependency of any case that came before them. I think that's what's really bothering Susan Collins the most, because she seems to have heard both in the hearings and in her office that this would not be overturned. And I think she feels a little bit maybe gullible, a little bit duped by the process.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs, political scientist at St. Norbert College, looking at the leak of a draft opinion that shows initial support in the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn the right to an abortion. It's not the final decision. Theoretically, justices could change their positions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That with your reaction, that's 800-642-1234. What do you think about the possible end of Roe v. Wade? What would you want to see here in Wisconsin? Current law, a very old law on the books, would theoretically come into effect banning almost all abortions. Is that the outcome you are hoping for? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College, with us today to talk about a leaked draft opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court that shows justices ready to overturn the right to an abortion if that leaked opinion holds. You can join in with your reactions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. This could be the end of the Roe versus Wade era. States allowed to enact any restrictions on abortion that state lawmakers see fit. If that's the case, what would you want to see here happen here in Wisconsin? Do you think the Supreme Court is getting it right if this holds? Do you want to see Congress take action one way or another? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to your calls now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, Charlie. A question is in relation to the other constitutional amendments, the freedom of speech, right to bear arms, and this draft opinion. How are the parallels, or is there any parallels between, say, the Second Amendment right to bear arms and the limitations that there presently exist on fully automatic weapons, depleted uranium shells, explosive shells, private ownership of anything larger than a half-inch caliber? I mean, does the removal or the language that is in this draft suddenly provide a case or ammunition that basically the NRA could come back and say, well, we want all of these restrictions removed from private ownership of these weapons?
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. I think it might be a big jump there, Charlie. I mean, it is an enumerated Bill of Rights, right? So that makes it kind of different. I don't know. Do you see any connections there?
Well, actually, there is a connection. And, you know, it's a good question, because the foundation for Alito's opinion is suggesting that the reason why the original holding is incorrect is because abortion isn't deeply rooted in our history and our tradition. And this is language that the court has used before. And if this is going to be the new benchmark, it means that using this sort of originalist construction to think about what rights we have under the Constitution, if something isn't deeply rooted in our tradition, then it might not be protected. So as sort of a hypothetical away from the Second Amendment, you could think of something like cruel and unusual punishment, and what type of punishments were deeply rooted in our tradition and what might not be acceptable now, or in what ways do we protect the rights of individuals from warrantless searches and seizure? Because there was a famous case from the 50s called Rochin v. California, where to get evidence, they forcibly pumped the person's stomach. So if these kinds of things were permissible in the past and deeply rooted, then they may come back. But other things that are protecting us now might disappear because it isn't deeply rooted. And so to his point about some of these new munitions, well, they might actually get banned under the same kind of thinking because they weren't part of the construct of weaponry back in the 17th and 18th century. So those are the kinds of things that we can think through, right? This is sort of the slippery slope. We start at the top thinking about Roe in this way, and what kind of other effects is it going to have on other rights? So Mike's right to think about this and think about it this deeply.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Amanda now in Madison. Amanda, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call and thanks for the conversation. Speaking on the sort of long-term effects of, like, if this were to be overturned, what does that mean long-term? Has the court offered up anything in this draft for, like, resources available to people who wouldn't be able to get the service? Or sort of, like, what's the long-term plan? If we're taking this healthcare away, then what, I guess, what do people look forward to as far as other resources?
Amanda, thanks for the call. We're going to talk about that more on the show tomorrow. Actually, Charlie, does the Supreme Court look at those outcomes that Amanda's talking about, women giving birth who hadn't planned to?
I would say actually the opposite from Alito's opinion, because this sort of states' rights stance that he's taking suggests we return this to the states. They create some parameters, which is you can ban this procedure except when it affects the life of the pregnant woman, which means that, in essence, all shackles are off about the regulation of this particular process. So what you can expect is what your state legislature will do to constrain or expand the right to abortion. Some states that want to ban it, at least partially, may still offer an avenue to women. Others may be a little bit more significant in the way in which they restrict banning it outright at any moment, except maybe to save the life of a woman, which could include, you know, issues of incest or rape or impregnation of a really young person that they would have to carry to term. So all of this is hypothetical and speculation on my part. It's going to be state dependent, and it's going to depend on what the final language of the final opinion will be from the court.
Amanda, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Lloyd joins us now in Greenfield. Lloyd, hi.
Yeah, hi. Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Lloyd?
Well, I told your screener that I think that the whole Roe v. Wade thing should be overturned. I think abortions are completely wrong. I don't think they should be allowed, period. The only possible exception would be if the mother potentially could die as a result. All the baloney about women's rights and so on is just that, baloney, because women have the choice not to get pregnant to begin with, but they do not have the right to kill another human being. And if you look at the laws, it says that if some guy attacks a woman who's pregnant and the fetus dies, well, guess what? He gets charged with killing it because it's a person. And there's no reason why an abortionist should be able to kill a person.
Lloyd, thanks for the call. Charlie Lloyd sums up the argument against abortion rights.
And, you know, there are some persuasive legal arguments about allowing, because this is not a specific right in the Constitution, like speech, like free exercise of religion, that it's something that should be left to the decision of majorities. But, you know, part of the, you know, structure and function of the American system of government that we can read quite extensively in the Federalist Papers and other places by our founders is, you know, the hope to protect minority rights in a whole scope of issues, not just abortion. And so we have to balance majoritarianism and the pursuit of a majority's right to control various aspects of our lives against a minority's ability to make their own decisions apart from the imposition of the will by the majority. It's a very difficult argument to have. And, you know, this is one of those ones that has been a touchstone for our politics and our debate for so many years in the United States. And it's one that's not going to be solved whether the court sustains or overturns Roe versus Wade.
Thanks for the call, Lloyd. Patricia joins us now in Kaukauna. Patricia, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So the question I have is specifically about the life of the mother. My understanding is that if Roe versus Wade is overturned, instantly in Wisconsin, we'll be in a situation where abortion will be illegal to perform unless the life of the mother is at stake, which sounds really clear cut, but it isn't, right? Because after all, like, there are some disorders like blood clotting disorders or, you know, various other disorders which can be triggered by a pregnancy. But it might not cause an immediate, urgent, life-threatening disorder. Who's going to make that call? A court? A doctor? Politicians?
Patricia, thanks for the call. Charlie?
And this is where it's going to get rather tricky with this legislation. Do you need two doctors to agree, one doctor to indicate, when we're talking about the life, as you know, as she suggests? Are we talking about mental health, physical health, long-term health, or effects that might not be immediate? So these kinds of things have to be grappled with. I mean, some of the more limiting laws that we've seen, in essence, suggest if the woman would die and die because you take the child to term. And so these are the kinds of things that are the unintended consequences of overturning a case like Roe versus Wade, and one that we're going to have to see unfold in the various states that want to change their laws if Roe is eventually wiped off the books.
Patricia, thanks for the call. And Charlie, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Charlie Jacobs, professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. He was with us today to talk about a leaked draft opinion in a U.S. Supreme Court case challenging abortion rights. The draft opinion shows a majority of justices ready to overturn the federal right to an abortion. It's not clear if justices will ultimately rule that way. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll get more of the fallout from that draft Supreme Court ruling on Roe v. Wade. Find out what it means in states around the country and more opportunities for you to join the conversation with your reactions, your thoughts about what could happen next, the possible consequences if Roe v. Wade is overturned. We've got stories on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can share your thoughts there as well. Also tomorrow, high demand for housing plus low supply means a lot of people in Wisconsin are scrambling to find a place to live that they can afford to live in. Our guest calls it a perfect storm. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the FDA laid out a proposal to ban menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars. We'll talk to a public health researcher about the health disparities from those products and the potential impacts of a ban. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the government gave out billions of dollars in contracts for medical supplies during the pandemic. Not all of that money was used honestly. We'll talk to the author of a new book on pandemic-era fraud. First, the Food and Drug Administration released its proposal last week to ban menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars. The FDA says the ban would reduce the number of young people who start smoking and help current smokers quit. It would also address health disparities by race and socioeconomic status. The tobacco industry is expected to challenge the ban, which would represent one of the largest regulations of their products in at least the last decade. We're learning more about the potential impacts of that kind of ban, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the FDA should ban menthol cigarettes and or flavored cigars? Should the FDA take more steps to regulate tobacco products? What regulations would you like to see? What questions do you have about who uses these kind of products? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sarah Mills is an assistant professor in the Department of Health Behavior at the Gillings School of Global Public Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She studies tobacco use and racial and socioeconomic health disparities, and she's looking at the possible impact of a menthol ban. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, how widely used are these products, the menthol cigarettes and the flavored cigars?
Well, about one third of smokers in the United States use menthol cigarettes. That's about 18 million people who use menthol cigarettes here.
What do we know about who is using them? Which demographic groups seem to use these menthol cigarettes in particular most?
Sure. Menthol cigarettes are used by about 85% of Black smokers as compared to 30% of white smokers. So there's stark racial disparities in use of menthol cigarettes. And this is a result of targeted marketing by the tobacco industry. Menthol cigarettes are also used at higher rates among people with lower incomes.
Let's talk more about the marketing. I know there have been campaigns in Milwaukee and other big cities around the country trying to give some kind of restrictions to the marketing of these products. What do we see when we look out there? How disproportionately are these products targeting Black smokers in particular?
Yeah, so targeted marketing by the tobacco industry of menthol cigarettes to Black communities in particular has gone on for decades and continues today. My own research finds that tobacco retailers in neighborhoods with a greater percentage of Black residents have more advertising for menthol cigarettes and cheaper prices for Newport menthol cigarettes, which is the most popular menthol cigarette brand. And what this does is it increases access to the product.
And now I just said marketing targeted to Black smokers. I guess a big part of the story here is, how much does this marketing affect non-smokers? How much of this is the way that people get onboarded, get brought into smoking in the first place?
That's a great point. So marketing study shows makes it more difficult for smokers to quit because they're constantly being reminded of tobacco. And it also increases smoking among youth. And so, you know, we're not only concerned about our smokers, but we're also interested in tobacco control and prevention and reducing youth smoking rates and trying to prevent them from using a cigarette at all.
Talking to Sarah Mills, who researches health behavior at the Gilling School of Global Public Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, looking at a proposed ban on menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars proposed by the FDA. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions on that, maybe your experiences, maybe the ads you see in your own community at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sarah, for those who haven't smoked cigarettes, what is it about menthol cigarettes? What is the specific appeal there?
Right. So menthol is an additive, and it's found in a number of products. It's found in shampoos, toothpaste. But when added to cigarettes, the analgesic and cooling effects of menthol help to mask the harshness of cigarette smoke. And this facilitates initiation. Menthol cigarettes are considered a starter product for youth. And the analgesic and cooling effects of menthol that help reduce that harshness of cigarette smoke makes it easier for youth to start using the product. And about 50% of youth, when they start smoking, they start with a menthol cigarette.
So to put it in really literal terms, that first drag of a cigarette, if it's from a menthol one, because of that slight numbing property, I'm less likely to gag on it?
Yep, that's correct.
Mm.
Studies...
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So in addition to these, to facilitating initiation, menthol cigarettes are also more difficult to quit than non-menthol cigarettes. And that's a problem because if you're less likely to quit, that in turn increases your likelihood of dying from tobacco-related disease.
And a key point here, I think people may have the sense, since it feels like it's smoother and less harsh, people might come away with the impression that a menthol cigarette is less unhealthy than a regular cigarette. That is not at all true, correct?
That's correct. There are studies that look at perceptions of the harm caused by menthol cigarettes as compared to non-menthol cigarettes. And individuals do believe that it's less harmful, but that's not the case at all. And actually, because they're more difficult to quit, they are considered more harmful than non-menthol cigarettes.
You are, I believe, currently engaged in research on the possible impact of a menthol cigarette ban. What kind of things are you looking at?
So I'm developing a simulation model to estimate the public health impact of a menthol cigarette ban on tobacco use and tobacco-related disease. And this work is part of a growing literature base that's using simulation to estimate the impacts of tobacco control policies. Right now, there are already simulation models out there that estimate that over a 40-year period, Up to 640,000 deaths in the United States would be averted if a national menthol cigarette ban were implemented.
We're talking about the FDA's proposed menthol cigarette and flavored cigar ban. Sarah Mills is with us, public health professor at the University of North Carolina, who studies, among other things, disparities in tobacco use and public health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a current or former smoker, were menthol cigarettes or flavored cigars some of your earliest experiences with smoking? What do you think in general about this idea of the FDA banning these products? Do you see a lot of marketing in your community for these flavored tobacco products? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with University of North Carolina public health professor Sarah Mills. With us today, looking at the health disparities in menthol cigarette use and the potential impact of an FDA ban proposed by the agency on menthol cigarettes as well as flavored cigars. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to that idea, your thoughts, your experiences. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to Kimberly in Arena now. Kimberly, hi.
Hi. So my boyfriend, he's trying to quit smoking, but when he was first starting, when he wouldn't use his credit card to buy the types of cigarettes that he buys, within a week he would get coupons in the mail for that particular brand of cigarettes that would be like $3 off or something. And I remember one time I bought him a pack of cigarettes, and I started getting those in the mail probably weekly for about 2 months.
Interesting, Kimberly. Thank you for sharing that with us, Sarah. I think of a cigarette advertising as the billboard or the sign in front of the store. It can be, Kimberly says, a little more subtle than that.
The tobacco industry now spends the majority of its marketing doing things just like that, sending coupons, and having price promotions like 2-for-1 deals that reduce the price of cigarettes and essentially increasing access to the product. Within tobacco control, one of our most effective interventions is to reduce smoking prevalence is to increase the price of tobacco products. And so the tobacco industry uses its marketing funding to keep prices low and keep access of these products to the public.
Thanks for that call, Kimberly, at 800-642-1234. Sarah, I've seen some concerns about how this might be enforced, especially if it focuses police attention on Black communities where these cigarettes are being sold. Do you have concerns about that there would be unintended consequences that would fall on the people that you're hoping to help with, or that people are hoping to help with this ban?
The tobacco industry is pushing these false claims that a menthol cigarette ban will subject Black Americans to more law enforcement abuse. The Food and Drug Administration is planning to ban the manufacture and sale of the product, and they're not planning to criminalize possession or use of the product. For years, the tobacco industry has funded organizations and prominent spokespeople to try to leverage real concern about law enforcement abuses into opposition to prohibiting menthol cigarettes. And this fear-mongering cannot hide the fact that it is the industry itself that has caused so much harm to Black Americans through their targeted marketing of this product. Racial bias and policing is an urgent problem that must be addressed. And the tobacco industry's targeting of the Black community with menthol cigarettes and the enormous harm that it has caused must also be addressed. We can and we must do both. This proposed ruling is not about criminalizing Black smokers. It's about saving Black lives.
Now, we heard from Reed in New Berlin, who wanted to know more about the science between menthol being more dangerous. I think you had said earlier, Sarah, that menthol cigarettes, people have a harder time quitting smoking them. Why would that be?
So there's different, I'm not a biologist, but there's different ideas about hypotheses about why menthol cigarettes in particular makes it more difficult to quit. One is that because menthol reduces the harshness of cigarette smoke, individuals are able to inhale the smoke more deeply. And this results in greater nicotine dependence, and it's nicotine dependence that drives addiction and makes it more difficult to quit.
Now, we have some precedent here. I understand, Sarah, there used to be other flavors of cigarettes, you know, like a berry flavor, the sort of things you might see in these flavored cigars. Have we learned anything from the impact of banning those other non-menthol flavors of cigarettes?
So in 2009, under the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act, all flavored cigarettes were banned except for menthol. And the reason why these flavors were banned is because flavors attract youth. And we have seen continuous reductions in youth smoking prevalence over time. The tobacco industry, of course, did not wanted to exempt menthol from that ruling in 2009 because the most popular flavor of cigarettes is menthol cigarettes. But to continue to prevent youth smoking and to reduce the harm that tobacco causes to the public health, it's critical to also ban menthol cigarettes.
Let's get to the outcomes now. What do we know about health disparities that the availability and the marketing of these products, these menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars, has on, as you mentioned earlier, Black communities and low-income communities?
So Black adults suffer the most from tobacco-related disease and mortality. They have the highest incidence and death rates from tobacco-related disease and mortality. And this is believed to be in part driven by their disproportionate use of menthol cigarettes. And so by banning this product, we think that we'll not only save lives overall in the total U.S. population, but we'll also see a disproportionate impact and positive public health impact in the Black community.
What would be a timeline if this is a proposed ban? What is the timeline from now until something like this coming into reality?
So this past week, FDA issued a proposed ruling. There'll be a comment period for several months where the public is able to comment on this proposed ruling. The FDA then needs to review all comments. FDA reviews every single comment made. That can take several months. After that, a rule would be finalized, and then there's typically a 12-month period before the effective date of a policy after a rule is finalized. So I'd say we're at least a year and some months away from the ban taking effect. However, the tobacco industry will likely sue, and that would delay the ban for longer.
And briefly, Sarah, I know another angle people have pursued is trying to cut down on marketing of these products. Do you see that as something that might be useful?
I do. Studies show that marketing is associated with tobacco use, cravings, and relapse. And so by restricting marketing, that is another tobacco control intervention that we can use to help reduce smoking prevalence.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Sarah Mills, assistant professor in the Department of Health Behavior at the Gillings School of Global Public Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's with us today for a look at the possible impact of a proposed ban on menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars. Still time for you to share your thoughts. Let us know what you think, maybe your own experiences, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Four years ago, an explosion at the Husky Energy Oil Refinery in Superior injured dozens of workers and forced a temporary evacuation of city residents. Now, documents obtained by WPR from federal regulators shed new light on what refinery officials knew leading up to the blast. As Danielle Kading reports, the refinery knew about erosion on a key piece of equipment a decade before the explosion.
The Superior Oil Refinery has operated in the city since 1950. Now construction is ongoing behind me, just a few miles from Lake Superior. The refinery's towers and tanks are still here, but there are cranes and contractors working on rebuilding the plant after an explosion 4 years ago. Most of the workers were on break when the explosion hit. Even so, three dozen people reported injuries that range from spinal fractures to minor cuts and bruises. Attorney Kyle Finley represents nine contractors who are suing the refinery for medical costs and lost wages.
The impact it had to hard hats being blown off, people knocked off scaffolding. I mean, it's a very traumatic event.
That night, refinery manager Colin Shady told reporters that the blast took place as the facility was shutting down for maintenance.
Throughout 2013, we did a similar event where we shut the entire refinery down. We go inside every vessel and we check everything for mechanical integrity.
The U.S. Chemical Safety Board said a worn valve likely caused the blast by allowing air to flow backwards inside a unit that's important for producing gasoline. And an investigation by federal labor regulators found the refinery could have prevented the explosion if it had properly maintained critical equipment. WPR obtained more than 1,300 pages of documents from that investigation by the Occupational Health and Safety Administration. They reveal the refinery knew about problems with erosion on that key valve a decade before the explosion. OSHA found the worn valve had been repaired during the refinery's last shutdown in 2013, and the one before that had been rebuilt in 2008. Holes in the valve were found during both shutdowns, and refinery workers knew the valve could leak because of erosion. In the final hours before the blast, workers reported hearing two booms from inside a refinery control room. Documents show the plant's operators and supervisors didn't fully investigate what had caused them. Finley says evidence shows things were going wrong for a long time.
When you don't take the precautions, exactly what you think will happen, and that is an explosion.
OSHA found the refinery should have inspected the valve more frequently and changed it out sooner. And the agency found no documented inspections of repairs to that valve by the refinery during the last two shutdowns. Operator logs also showed the worn valve was malfunctioning in the days leading up to the explosion. Plant managers had changed its shutdown procedure just a day before the incident and hadn't given operators adequate training. Jordan Barab served as OSHA's assistant deputy secretary during the Obama administration. He says it's not uncommon to see procedures and training that don't keep up with changes at refineries.
Rewriting procedures and retraining workers and all that kind of stuff is not something that directly leads to a profit. It's easy to cut corners there.
Barab says it's important to have strong involvement from workers or unions to promote safety. WPR reached out to nine contract companies on site that day and four local union representatives, but none agreed to speak publicly. Atticus Larson is a refinery electrician and member of the International Union of Operating Engineers Local 420. In late 2018, Larson said during a Chemical Safety Board meeting in Superior that no price can be put on safety.
Did people think safety was expensive before? Look what it costs us now. We need to start using the most up-to-date safety standards that have been in the industry for years. The most important thing, period, is for everyone to go home safely after every shift to their family.
Last year, Husky merged with Cenovus Energy in a roughly $5 billion deal. In an earnings call last week, the company said the $1.2 billion rebuild has the refinery on track to resume normal operations early next year. A Cenovus spokesperson said in a statement that the refinery is being rebuilt with state-of-the-art equipment. That includes new slide valves. The lawsuit from contractors who were caught in the 2018 explosion is still ongoing. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, the Justice Department continues to investigate the misuse of federal contracts given out during the pandemic for key medical supplies. A journalist and author of a new book joins us to share what he's found in 2 years of covering pandemic-related fraud, how we got there, what's being done about it now. Remember, you can follow great conversations like these anytime over at WPR.org, stream live, check out the archives, and share your favorite conversations with friends and family. You can also download the Wisconsin Public Radio app and listen wherever you go. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.